I'm going to quit my job and go to work for the Lord. It was a shocking statement because I was sitting in this well-appointed living room. The man to whom I was talking worked for a large company that had branches and installations all over the world. I knew that that he traveled all over the world. I also knew that he was a constant witness to his beliefs, because these projects would have to stop on Friday evening before sundown and wouldn't continue until after the sundown on Sabbath evening. And many times he was called to give a testimony as to why. So I felt that he possibly was able to give a knowledge of the true Sabbath and possibly other tenets of his faith to people that never would have heard it any other way, worldwide. Now he was proposing that he quit this job and go to work for the Lord. Well, whatever. There are many ways to work for the Lord, and he was going to take one of these. I tried to talk him out of it. I tried to point out to him that I felt that he was doing the Lord's work now in a way that very few people could ever do. I almost thought I succeeded, but I didn't. His mind was made up. He had had plans, and he did. He quit his job and went to work for the Lord. I am glad that I am not a judge, neither would I have the information which a person would need to make an evaluation, because I don't know what happened. But I have always wondered, is he making the contribution today that he was making before? I have often wondered. But very often I read this in some periodical where a person who has given his heart to the Lord is now quitting his job and he's going to go to work for the Lord. And that's the way they state it. I think this unfortunate idea dates to the limited educational goals we have had or have had for years, where a person going to school was either going to be a doctor, a preacher, or a teacher in that order. And other occupations were regarded as inferior. And people who were taking these other courses of training were regarded with some degree of condescension, or at least a degree of pity. And very often in this day of women's lib, you'll hear a lady say, "Well, I'm just a housewife." But what about this? From Volume 5, Testimonies to the Church, page 219. The mother who trains her children for Christ is as truly working for God as is the minister in the pulpit. Just a housewife? I think not. Just as important. The devil has a real trap here. He wants men to separate their religion from their employment. If he can get them to do this, then the actions in their business life will counteract the profession of their spiritual life. But are they separate? The answer is no. Religion and business are not two separate things. They are one. Bible religion is to be interwoven with all we do or say. Divine and human agencies are to combine in temporal as well as in spiritual achievements. And I'm quoting from the book Education, page 349-350. What does it say again? Religion and business are one. They are not two separate things. Let us look at our business, and when I'm talking about business, I'm talking about occupation or any gainful employment. Let's look at it from first the personal benefit. We have the pattern. Did you ever think of Eden as being the first trade school? Well, most people don't. They think it was a kind of a botanical garden, but actually it was a trade school. We're told that God gave Adam and Eve employment. Eden was the school for our first parents, and God was their instructor. They learned to till the soil, to care for the things which the Lord had planted. They did not regard labor as degrading, but as a great blessing. So here we have Eden as the trade school. After the fall, the decree that man should earn his bread by the sweat of his brow was not given as a curse. Many times we think of this. We think of briars and thorns being thrown out of his home, all of these things, and he has to earn his bread by the sweat of his brow as being a great curse. Actually, it was not a curse at all. Through faith and hope, labor was to be a great blessing to the descendants of Adam and Eve, and it has ever proved to be thus. That's a quotation. It comes from Fundamentals of Christian Education, page 314. Through faith and hope, labor was to be a blessing to the descendants of Adam and Eve. Well, you can understand this, because today, the most miserable people in the whole world are those who have nothing to do. The so-called jet set, going from here to there and from there to here. Back and forth, looking for some type of new thrill. Bored to death. Let's look at the benefits of labor. First, there is a principle that there is honor in any class of work that is essential to be done. Isn't that beautiful? Anything that needs to be done is essential, and it's an honorable work. That also, in case you're keeping track, comes from Fundamentals of Christian Education, page 315. You know, the first time I read that, I got to thinking about it. I grew up on a farm. There were certain things that I didn't think were all too honorable, but they sure needed to be done. And when I said to my dad, I don't like to do it, he said, but it needs to be done. So I don't know whether he ever read this quotation or not, but he certainly had the principle that there is honor in any class of work that needs to be done. As a matter of fact, we're to teach children that there is honor in any work that needs to be done. Why do we labor? First, to make a living. This is obvious. We need food, shelter, and clothing. Second, and equally important, as a balance between the body and the mind. Every faculty of the mind may be exercised with comparative safety. Notice, if the physical powers are equally taxed and the subject of thought varied. That comes from the same source. But you can see the principle back there, that if you only exercise the mind and not the body, the mind will not function properly, and vice versa. Then labor gives us the opportunity to develop our talents. I wonder if we ever begin to realize what we could do if we needed to, or if we had opportunity. Why, there are talents which we have that lie completely unused. I didn't know that I could tune an automobile. I could change a spark plug. I'm not sure I did it with exactly the right torque. I could change the oil in the filter. I knew how to do that. But to tune the car, no. But when I had the big ripoff from a garage one time and found out that I'd paid $50 and they hadn't done anything and became very unhappy, I had to be unhappy to go and sign up to go to school. I really did at my age. I was way past that. But I went to community college and signed up for a course in automotive. And after the first evening, I wished I hadn't been so brash, believe me, because here I was dealing with people that knew something about it, and I didn't know anything. I didn't know a crankshaft from a camshaft or anything else. And I felt completely dumb and said, what did you do this for? You know, well, fortunately, I knew what to do. I went to the library, got a book on the automobile engine and its history and everything, and when I came to the next week, I knew something about it. And I found out that I had had some skills that lay dormant all these years that I could use so that I could tune a car very successfully, too. which triggers some thinking in my mind. What other things could I do if I really set my mind to it or if I really needed to? And so labor gives us this opportunity to do this. And in our labor, we're not to be satisfied to just do it as the same old way. We're to look for new and better methods and more efficient methods to do it. And this develops our talents. There is a very important part to labor, number four, which we'll call a development of character. Notice in labor that you can cultivate carefulness, patience, attention to detail. And you can weave the principles of truth into your daily life. And then, as we have mentioned, that labor can sharpen our minds in devising better methods. How does God regard labor? It is just as essential to the will of God, we read, when erecting a building as when taking part in a religious service. Now, that is a thought that rarely comes across people's minds. Just as essential to the will of God when erecting a building as when taking part in a religious service. And if the workers have brought the right principles into their character making, then in the erection of every building, they will grow in grace and knowledge. My, what a promise that is for the carpenter and the plumber and the sheetrock man and everybody, isn't it? It comes from Christ's Object Lessons, page 350. Also from the same source, there is a need of businessmen who will weave the grand principles of truth into all their transactions. Well, there's another great reason for labor. It's a great benefit to the Gospel Commission. We normally think of everyday labor by laymen as being monetary support. But what about personal witness? Not only can he furnish monetary support to carry the gospel to the world, but also, and more important, is his personal witness. And we're told that we should fear to leave our appointed work unless the Lord clearly indicates our duty to serve him in another field. That comes from volume 5, page 184. In volume 5, page 219, a man may be in the active service of God while engaged in everyday duties, while felling trees. There's the logger. Clearing the ground and following the plow. There's the farmer. Now notice, in the active service of God, as a logger, as a farmer. It may be of some interest to realize that in the Bible, some of the very notable people were laymen, really. They weren't priests. Take, for instance, Elijah. Elijah was a farmer, lived out on the hills of Gilboa. And one day the Lord said, Elijah, I've got a job for you. I want you to go up to Samaria and deliver my latest weather report. So Elijah left his plow and headed for Samaria. And he knew that he was going to have to tell Ahab there wasn't going to be rain for at least 3 years. And what would he run into with a message like that? As he went down these beautiful verdant hills with their flowing trees, walked across the crystal clear streams and saw the flowers waving, it was almost unbelievable that such a thing could possibly happen. And certainly when you look at Palestine today, it's rather unbelievable. At once it was a land flowing with milk and honey, isn't it? Well, all the topsoil blew away during those 3.5 years, believe me. But finally here he is in Samaria and he strides into the palace. The guards didn't even see him, I guess. Walked in, he said to Ahab, it isn't going to rain for 3.5 years. Strode out again. The old Ahab was so flabbergasted, he couldn't even say, stop that man. The next time we see Elijah, he's way down in the brook Cherith, way down that deep canyon. The Lord has a catering service set up down there, and he used ravens for waiters. Would you think that Joseph was working for the Lord? Well, now think of it carefully. Here he is, he's the pampered son of a desert sheik. His brothers aren't too happy with some of the dreams that he has interpreted. And now he goes out, sent out by his father to find out how they are. They toss him in a hole in the ground, pull him out, sell him to some Ishmaelites, and pretty soon he's down in Egypt, and he's a slave. Working for the Lord? Well, he evidently was a good one. because pretty soon he became his master's personal attendant. And then because of his moral integrity, he got thrown in jail. It didn't look like much of a reward. And there he languished down there for 2 years. And then all of a sudden, he becomes the prime minister of Egypt, and he becomes the master of his former owner. Now talk about a reversal. There it is. A master of his former owner. Working for the Lord? What about Nehemiah? He was a waiter in the Persian court. But because he was so honest in his work and he had such a fine attitude, he became a confidant of the king and a friend. And when he needed a particular person to go back to Palestine and help the Jews build the walls and a few things, he put Nehemiah in charge. What about Daniel? He was the president of the greatest city in the whole world, and he survived 3 administrations. Notice that. They tore everything up, but Daniel still stayed there as president. But nowhere do we find where God ever asked Elijah, Joseph, Nehemiah, Daniel, or some others to quit his job and go to work for him, whatever that means. However, I think for sheer audacity and raw courage, there is absolutely nothing that equals a little slave girl. You remember the time when the Assyrians were having one of their border incidents with Israel? I guess it's been going on for centuries, hasn't it? They're still doing it. At any rate, the Syrians swept across, probably burned the town down, killed everybody in the town except maybe this little girl and some others. And the captain took the little girl back to his wife back in Damascus and said, "Here's another one." They didn't even give her a name. She wouldn't be worth as much as a donkey anyway. And if any little slave girl had the right to be happy when she saw the leprosy which her master had, she did. I suppose some of us would have said, "It's good enough for him, mean old thing. I hope he gets quietly, of course, so nobody could hear us. I hope he gets as spotted as a hyena." But not this little slave girl. One day she said, I wish my master was with the prophet in Samaria. He would recover him of his leprosy." Imagine, he's killed her parents, destroyed her home. She's way off in this foreign country. And she wishes that he could get over his leprosy. Well, somebody told the mistress, she told the master, he called the State Department. Before long, you see Naaman, the captain of the king's guard, with a whole group of cavalry, and they've got a safe conduct pass, and he gallops out the gate of Damascus. He has $6,000 in silver, $55,000 in gold, and 10 very expensive suits. He's heading for Samaria, where he was recovered of his leprosy. Now, the question I want to ask is this. How long would it have taken an evangelistic team to do what she did? Now, you stop and think of it. She brought, because of her witness, she brought a knowledge of the true God to the whole nation of Assyria. How long would it have taken the evangelistic team? I will agree that Naaman's wife had a slave, but I want you to see that God had a little girl working for him. When she said, "I would that my master was with the prophet in Samaria, he would recover him of his leprosy." You know, sometimes we get the idea that Jesus was advising everyone to leave their jobs and go to work for him because he talked Peter, James, and John out of going out of the fish business, and Matthew into leaving the IRS. But he didn't ask Zacchaeus to do it, or Nicodemus, or his best friend Lazarus, or even that crazy fellow. Remember that one? Well, he went across the lake. And here was this crazy man, didn't have any clothes on, had chains dangling, he came down and he was just, you know, matted hair. He was a terrible thing. The disciples took off. Jesus held up his hand, stopped, cast out the devil. It's the one where the story where the fellow put them all out of the pig business. Remember, the devils went in the pigs and landed in the lake. Now, as I recall the story, he wanted to go to work for Jesus. Here he is sitting, clothed, and in his right mind. And he said, "Master, let me go with you." And what did Jesus tell him to do? Tell him to go home. Go home and tell them, thy friends, how great things the Lord hath done for thee. I'm reading from Mark 5:19. Personal witness was evidently the key to working for God. I had just picked up some delicious food and placed it on a tray in the cafeteria at camp meeting. I was looking for a place to put the tray. And it was pretty crowded. And I looked around, didn't see any vacant seats. And pretty soon I saw a hand way over against the wall, so I went over there. Here was a man and a lady and a little boy in a high chair, and they had an extra chair. And he said, please eat here. Well, I thanked him. After I thanked the Lord for the food, I asked their names, and he told me his name. They knew me because I was holding a series there. And I said, what do you do? And he said, I'm an engineer for 3M. And I remember they thought, as quick as he said, I'm an engineer for 3M, I wondered, how does a fellow, an engineer for 3M, how can he be a Seventh-day Adventist? So you'll get a kind of an idea of who he was. He was in charge of the big plant that they put into Alaska to treat and bake those large sections of pipe for the pipeline, the oil line. So I said, finally, have you been an Adventist all your life? And he said, no, only 2 years. I said, oh? Well, how did you become a Seventh-day Adventist? He started to smile. He looked at his wife, and I noticed she smiled. And he said, well, that's quite a story. And I said, well, I have 2 hours for my next meeting. I listened to one of the most intriguing stories, and there were some other people I saw that weren't too interested in leaving the cafeteria either, because he was a rather dynamic person. And when he really got into the story, he showed this quality which he had. He said, I grew up in a home where there was never a Bible. Nobody believed in God. And he said, I was an atheist. I didn't believe there was a God. After college, he said, I went to get a job. I went to work for 3M as an engineer. He said, in the office where I worked was another engineer. We were on the same level. And he said, this fellow was a Christian, and he was a witnessing Christian. Oh, brother, he said, you should see him witness. Man, he said, he was forever giving me books, giving me magazines, subscribing to something, inviting me to go to evangelistic meetings, inviting me to go to church. He was always after me. And he said he was such a nice fellow, I didn't want to hurt his feelings, so I'd throw the books in the garbage can on the way home. I had another appointment. I couldn't go to the meetings. I just kept going, no, no, no. But he said, finally got to me. And I said to him one day, I said, look, you're a nice guy and I like you, but let's leave this religion bit alone, okay? Because I don't believe it. And the fellow said, okay. So he said, he never spoke to me about religion again. But he said, I was drawn to this person. I really don't know why. He said, I just wanted to be around him. When there were problems and he was being blamed, he was so calm. Never retaliate. He says, I just couldn't understand it. And he said, I found something else was very disturbing. On my day off, I'd end up at his place just as sure as the world. He said, I decided I was going to go fishing, go play golf, go do something. He said, my car only needed one place to go, and over at his place, and I'd be over there working all day long, around his shop, out in the garden. He said, close the day on my way back. I said, boy, are you stupid. Here you have a day off, and look what you're doing. You're over here working. Well, he said, I went back to my old home state, married a girl there, and came back and settled in our home. He said, we had a nice home. Eventually, a little boy came along. That added to our happiness. One day, he said, I had some egg on my fork, and I was just ready to put it in my mouth. And when my wife said, my son and I are going to join the church. And he said, I put my fork down and I said, now let's get something real straight. There's not going to be any religion in this house. And she set her jaw and she said, you can stay home, but I'm not going to have my son grow up outside the church. We're going to join a church. So he said, hold it, wait a minute, back up. Whoa, whoa, he said, wait. He said, remember, this is my son too. What this family does, it's going to do together. Get your coat. She said, my coat. He said, yeah, get your coat. Why? Don't talk to me, just get your coat. He left his breakfast, got up, picked up the little boy, got his coat. They got into the car. She said, where are you going? He said, just don't say anything now. Over to his friend's house he went, put his finger in the doorbell. His friend came to the door and said, hey, man, it's great to see you. Come on in. He said, what church do you go to? He said, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist. He turned to his wife. He said, that's where we're going. She said, never heard of it. He said, neither did I, but that's where we're going. He said, what are you supposed to do? His friend said, I guess you ought to have some Bible studies. He said, well, here we are. Here we are. Let's get started. And that's how come he became a Seventh-day Adventist. I said, how's it been? He said, the happiest 2 years of my life. His wife said, me too. Then I will never forget what he finally added. He said, you will never know how happy I am that my friend lived his religion. Now, here was a man that all the call porters in the world couldn't touch. All the radio or TV evangelists could never get near. It took the personal witness of a man working alongside of him to do it. In God's original plan, there probably wouldn't have needed so many varied talents. But after sin entered the world, the first thing they needed was a tailor. Then some gardening tools and probably medical attention, house builders and stonemasons. And God knew we would need all of these, including garbage collectors. And they found that out in New York when the garbage started to pile up to the second story window. In God's plan, every talent is essential. Every talent is useful. Every job is essential. We're told that different qualifications are needed in different departments of the work. The carpenter is not fitted to work at the anvil, nor the blacksmith to use the plane. The merchant would be out of place beside the sick bed, and the doctor in the counting room. This principle was paramount in Israel. Farmers, artisans, teachers, physicians, and those who cared for the tabernacle, the priests, by their health and prosperity, they would have been a constant witness to the world. Not just the Levites, but the farmer, the stable boy, the merchant, maybe the merchant more than all, because by his courtesy and kindness and integrity, he would give a witness to a world filled with cheaters and chiselers. That's why he was directed in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. You shall not pervert justice in measurement of length, weight, or quantity. You shall have true scales, true weights, true measures, dry and liquid. And today we could stand some of these honest merchants. Because we live in a world with cheaters and chiselers, but we as Christians have the opportunity of using true scales, true weights, true measures, dry and liquid, and an honest day's labor. We need it today. We're told that we may be placed in circumstances of great difficulty and trial, but this does not prove that we're not in the very position God assigned by us. There was a young man who left the church, joined the Navy, led a rather wild life, and then finally saw that this wasn't the way to go, and before he left the Navy, he gave his heart back to God. When he got out of the Navy, he couldn't find a job except as mail carrier. Always was talking about quitting his job and going to work for the Lord, but nothing ever opened up. And so he carried mail. He tried to witness, not too successfully, I'll admit, in certain areas. He tried to witness. Way down at the end of his route, there was a man and his wife. He talked to them about Christ one day. And then he was transferred somewhere else. One night, he received a telephone call from these people from his former route. They said, could you come to our house? And the man's voice told him something serious had happened, and it had. The man had left that morning, backed down the driveway over his little two-year-old boy and killed him. They were absolutely desperate. They had no hope. They spent all day long just with no hope at all. They had to have something. And finally, they got to thinking, who could possibly help us? And they remembered the mailman. He was the only one who had ever showed an interest in them personally. He was able to point them to God, to the coming of Jesus, so they could be reunited with the little boy. He gave Bible studies to these people. Elder Ron Flowers, who was a pastor near there, continued the Bible studies, and eventually they were baptized, and now in the hope of Jesus' soon return, looking forward to meeting their little boy. The active man in business will have difficulties, there's no doubt about it. There's one of the most beautiful promises. It says that his great need will be the mighty argument that will prevail with God. We need to understand these great principles, that our job is our religion and can be nothing else.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. International copyright 2008, all rights reserved. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.